When we think about the apostles being on the storm-tossed Sea of Galilee and Jesus asleep, we can certainly feel for them. And as we noted in our study last week, there was a lot of terror with one of the apostles even asking Jesus, "Do you not even care that we're going to perish?" Jesus did not cut them any slack on that and said, "Where was your faith and through all this? Didn't you trust me?" And as they watch this Prince of Peace not being extremely peaceful toward them, they're amazed when he speaks and the storm instantaneously calms. And it leaves them with a question, who is this man? Certainly before they had theoretically understood, but yet this came to a time when they must come to grips with the idea of who Jesus truly is. It's interesting that in all three of the Gospels that tell this account, it's immediately followed with another account that is going to show Jesus in a very unpeaceful situation. And although the apostles are going to be silent witnesses to all of the events that come when they do cross the sea and come to the other side, they all are going to get their answer of who this is, because they are going to see the power of Jesus on display once again, but in this account, in a very different way. So in our study today, we're going to talk about one of the strangest accounts that we find in the life of Jesus, when Jesus is met with a whole host of demons and the action that he takes to deal with those. Along those lines, I might simply say that it's very easy in this study to get sidetracked. There are so many things for which we would like to have an answer that the writers simply do not tell us. And so to that idea, I would simply say that if we keep the phrase setting the stage in mind, it's going to help us. We know that when a theatrical performance is put on, there's a whole crew that gets the setting exactly right so that it's going to make the play much more meaningful. Well, this is certainly not a play nor any kind of fiction. It was all reality. Yet what we find is that much of what the writers are telling us about is setting the stage for a very important choice that had to be made. With those thoughts in mind, let's go ahead and enter into our study today. As we look at this time when Jesus and his disciples come to the other side of Galilee after they've experienced the storm, Jesus is immediately met with a whole host of things that are going to bring about the idea of uncleanness. So let's talk about this part of setting the stage. Matthew tells us that as soon as they land, Jesus is met by two demon-possessed men. If we look at this in Mark and Luke, they're going to tell us only about one of these men. They're going to focus in on the one really who's doing the speaking here. So here we are. We get across the sea. Immediately we find that Jesus is confronted by evil, this demon possession that was in these two men. And even the setting itself is going to display a great deal of uncleanness. First of all, likely where they land was a place where Gentiles lived. And for Jews, automatically that would have made this place to seem unclean. Yet each of the gospel writers is going to give us other ideas that help us to understand this is not a good place where Jesus has come. First of all, there's half a legion of pigs present. And we know for a Jew, that would have immediately signaled a place of uncleanness. Leviticus 11, verse 7 tells us that a pig was to be considered an unclean animal. So whereas today, there's no difference between a pig and anything else, under the law of Moses, there most definitely was. And so a place where there are Gentiles who are herding over 2,000 pigs is telling a story to the Jews and saying, this is a place that is very unclean. And as the writers introduce us to this man that Mark and Luke are going to focus on, the idea of uncleanness continues. The writers tell us that the man was naked. We understand that nakedness under the law of Moses held a fairly negative connotation. And because it was oftentimes associated with sexual sin, God said, I don't want anyone going out in public in any way exposing himself or herself. And a good illustration of that is found in Exodus 20 as well as Exodus 28, where Moses is specifically telling the priest how to design their garments. He says, now you're going to be going up on a higher level than worshipers, and you need to make sure that you are completely covered when you go up. That passage illustrates to us that God wanted everyone decent, yet what do the writers tell us about this man? This man was totally indecent. Here he is, he's living in such a way that just by very appearance, he's showing this disregard for a law that God had put into place. And not only that, we're told that he lived amongst the tombs. In Numbers chapter 5 and verse 2, we're told that coming into contact with a dead body would make one unclean. And so cemeteries, graveyards were considered to be places of uncleanness because of that. In fact, Jesus himself in Matthew 23 is going to tell the Pharisees, you're like whitewashed tombs filled with all manner of uncleanness. So here is this man who is in a Gentile region where there's lots of pigs going around naked, living amongst the tombs. And yet we add one more thing in. The writers tell us that he cut himself with stones. I don't know that God is telling us that this was necessarily an unclean thing, yet in Leviticus 19 and also in chapter 21, we find where God says, do not cut yourself. And the cuttings described there typically referred to kind of a pagan ritual that would go on, yet what we're seeing is that God is saying, I have given you a body, do not desecrate this body, do not damage it. And yet here is this man, perhaps to show us uncleanness, for sure to show us the evil and the danger that these demons have put him in, is cutting himself. So look at the scene, look at the stage. Gentiles, pigs, a naked man living amongst the tombs, cutting himself. The writers are showing us here, this is a bad, bad situation. No surprise that they also tell us that the townspeople lived in terror. We're told specifically they tried to chain these demon-possessed men up. They tried to put them in shackles. And it says because of these demons, they could just burst through the chains, break off the shackles. So it's no surprise to us that these townspeople were terrified of what was going on. Jesus, however, was not. And so as he comes and these demon-possessed men, and from here on out, we'll just go with Mark and Luke and focus on the one. As the man approaches Jesus, Jesus is not going to be at all alarmed by this, as others were. But it's interesting that at the very introduction of this, we find that the demon-possessed man comes up to Jesus, bows before him, and says, you are the Son of the Most High God. Now let's put everything together. Immediately preceding this in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is the account of the storming of the sea. And the last part of that is the disciples asking the question, who is this one that even the winds and the sea obey him? And the demons answer that question. The apostles have asked, who is this one? And the writers, through the words of these demons, immediately tell us who this one is. And that is the Son of the Most High God. As this continues on, Jesus immediately begins casting out the demons. So, Mark shows us this in his gospel, that as Jesus sees what's going on, it's almost as if Jesus is saying, I am not going to be sidetracked by all of this. And so he starts casting the demons out. Yet, very unusual here, whereas Jesus would usually tell the demons, be quiet and leave, and they would, there's actually going to be a conversation that takes place here. Because as Jesus is casting out the demons interrupt him, and they make a request of Jesus. Now again, I believe in almost every other account where the demon is being cast out, Jesus doesn't listen, but here he does. Again, setting the stage for what's going on. So Jesus stops and he says, okay, I'm going to let this demon talk. And let's look at what the demon has to say. Matthew's account says, they cried out, what have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? Mark adds, crying with a loud voice, he said, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment us. Luke concludes, Jesus, when he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me. And then on down in verse 31, it says, they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Well, we find a lot out here, don't we, in just a short period, that first of all, they not only know who Jesus is, they know that Jesus is most surely associated with God, and oddly enough, in Mark's account, you've got the demon adjuring Jesus in the name of God. Isn't that strange? But the request in all three accounts is the same. Don't cause us pain before that time of pain must come. These demons knew that they had a very limited time on earth and that their future was not a good one. And they did not want to hasten that future in any way. And so they begged Jesus, don't send us out yet. The time hasn't come. Don't let us go to that abyss, that place of eternal destruction quite yet. The demons are terrified. While they were terrifying the townspeople, they in turn are terrified by Jesus himself and begging, don't send us to that place. So Jesus asks for a name, which again is rather odd, isn't it? And so Jesus says, okay, demons, what's your name? And perhaps the spokesman for the group here says, well, you can call us Legion because there's a whole bunch of us. Now, does that mean there were 2,000 demons in this poor man or these men? I don't know the answer to that, but there was a bunch of them. And the demon says, there's a whole lot of us here. And he follows that with another request. He's requested that Jesus not send them into the abyss. And now he's going to try to figure out a way for that not to happen. And so here's what the demon says. He begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him saying, send us to the pigs. Let us enter them. Here is one of those places where we want to stop and have so many questions answered for us. What did the demons think was going to happen? Why these pigs? Perhaps even greater question, why does Jesus give them permission? Let's not stop and get ourselves off track and miss the point of where the riders are leading us. So we'll just leave it at that. They ask, and Jesus said, yes. And what happens after that gets even stranger. So the demons then go into this group of pigs, this herd of pigs. It says the unclean spirit came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. Did Jesus know that was going to happen? I feel quite confident in my answer that that's yes. And so the demons, thinking they had figured out a way to compromise with Jesus, find out that the compromise was not the case. And so here these pigs are now dead. The demons are not in a host. And so surely they have gone into eternity to suffer because of their rebellion against God. But let's continue building our case here. Because we're coming to really what I believe is the crescendo of the account. Here is the point that the writers have been leading us to all along. They have meticulously set the stage, a place of uncleanness, demon-possessed man who's naked and cutting himself and living amongst the tombs, demons who speak to Jesus, that are terrified of him, who recognize him, who ask him something thinking they can compromise only to learn you don't compromise with God. But now we're ready for the crux of the account. The herdsmen immediately go to the townspeople, as we can only imagine they would have. And they're going to say, you're never going to believe what just happened. The townspeople, hearing this fantastic story, come out to see for themselves. And let's think about what they find here, again, kind of setting the stage. As they look around, they find that there are 2,000 pig carcasses floating in the water. And not only that, this man who had terrorized them, who had caused them to live in fear, who is a man who bespoke uncleanness in every sense of the term, is now clothed and in his right mind and sitting at the feet of Jesus. And there in the midst of all of this is Jesus, who has shown power over uncleanness and fear. Just put yourself in that position. You can understand why the people are fearful. All of these dead pigs, here is this man who they were so terribly afraid of, and he looks as normal as anybody else, and Jesus, who is firmly in control of the situation. We find here two very different reactions. As the townspeople take all of this in, we learn that those who were fearful of Legion are now fearful of Jesus. And they make one of the saddest requests in the entire New Testament. Mark tells us they begin to beg Jesus to depart from their region. They couldn't handle this. Though Jesus had surely been the answer to their prayers to do something with this demon possession, to let them live a peaceful life once again, they cannot comprehend the whole scene, and they cannot wrap their minds around someone who has the power to take this evil out of a man and to put it in a situation where it will never be a problem for them again. And rather than accepting that as this grand testimony of the power of a Messiah, they say, please go away. Please don't stay here any longer. And Jesus is going to fulfill their request. But there was one who made a very different choice. This man who had been plagued with this host of demons, this man who had lived his life away from society, terrorized with these evil forces causing even physical pain for him, notice what he does. Mark also includes for us the man who had been possessed with demons begged Jesus that he might be with him. On the one hand, we've got a group of folks begging Jesus to leave. On the other hand, we have a man begging, let me go with you. Let me stay with you. What a contrast. And I believe that's where the writers have brought us. Here is the choice. Do away with Jesus or beg to go with him. Interestingly, Jesus is not going to allow the man to go because Jesus has much greater work for him to do. So here are these townspeople who are left in sins. And to the best of my knowledge, Jesus never returned to them. He never came back to give them another chance. They had had their occasion to meet the Savior, to see His power, to understand what they were being offered, yet they dismissed Him. But He says to this man, I don't want you to go with me because there are things I need you to do. And so Jesus said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how He has had mercy on you. This man becomes a missionary for Jesus Christ. Normally, Jesus would say, don't speak a word. Don't tell anybody what you've seen. But since Jesus would not be returning, at least in any kind of capacity to teach large crowds, He says to the man, you go and you tell them what I've done. Don't stay silent about it. Speak the mercy of God And the man, truly converted to the Lord, does that very thing. He went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. So here is a man representing the power of God through Jesus Christ. And I don't know how many of these folks who heard the man were converted, but yet he got their attention. Here's the point. There is a choice that must be made when you are confronted with the power of God. When the Prince of Peace may not look all that peaceful to you, you've got a choice that must be made. And that choice comes to you and me. And I believe there's two very important lessons that we need to learn from this account. One of these, very simply put, is we need to understand that evil is a very powerful enemy. On our own, there's not much we can do about evil once it comes into our lives. We look at this man, and certainly there's a difference between us and him. Demon possession seemed to be a random thing, and once the host was taken, not a lot he could do about it. But yet, look at the picture for us. Once we voluntarily sell ourselves into evil, that's that. On our own, we're no match for it. In fact, the Apostle Paul shows us just how powerful this evil is as he writes to the Ephesians, and he says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over the present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places." This one verse is showing us all of the things that are just outside of our purview that are making war on our souls. And he says you need to understand that, because on your own, there's not a lot you can do about it. Yet, what we understand is that there is someone who can. And Psalm 124 draws this contrast so beautifully. Psalm 124 says, "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side," let Israel now say, "if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when people rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us up alive when their anger was kindled against us. Then the flood would have swept us away. The torrent would have gone over us. Then over us would have gone the raging waters." I think the apostles could relate to that, couldn't they, in the storm that had just come. "Blessed be the Lord who has not given us as prey to their teeth. We have escaped like a bird from the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken and we have escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth." The psalmist realized if God was not there, the enemy would win. And when we think about evil, that is exactly what we need to understand. If God is not present, evil is going to win. But the entire message of this account that we've just studied is that when God is on our side, God will prevail. God will defeat evil. So that leads us to the second important lesson. It's to understand that God is there for us. So the apostle, putting all this together now in Ephesians 6, he says, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of His might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil." And then we read that passage that we just read, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in that day, and having done all, to stand firm." What is that second important lesson? It's that Jesus must be chosen. How do we put on the armor of God? How do we stand against these evil forces? It is in Jesus Christ. That's what these townspeople should have learned. That's what the demon-possessed man did learn. And that's what you and I must learn as well. The townspeople saw his power but they chose fear. And in the 21st century, many people still turn away because of fear. Fear of commitment, fear that you can't measure up, fear of the expectations. And so there are many people who, like those townspeople, when they see the power of the Prince of Peace, they say, I can't deal with it. I need you to go away. And the thing is, Jesus will still go away if that's the request. But how much better to be like this man who was cleansed, who made the right choice. How much better to stand with him in the choice that he made, that when he came into contact with Jesus, he saw the power of God and he said, I want a part of that power. I want to be with you. Here's the point of our story. Here's the point of our choice. That we are either going to choose to allow evil to continue unchecked, or we're going to come to terms with the power of God manifested in Jesus Christ and to choose Him over evil. We have to take this outside of the realm of theoretics. We have to understand that this choice is my choice. Will I choose as this man chose? You see, Jesus still, in the 21st century, has the power to free people from evil. All these years after he sat with that man on the side of the sea, he still can take evil out of lives today. That was part of his opening commission. If you'll recall there in Nazareth when he opened the scrolls up to demonstrate to his town people who he was, he quoted from Isaiah, when Isaiah, as recorded by Luke, said, He has sent me to proclaim liberty for the captives. That's us. We're captive in sin. We've sold ourselves out. It wasn't a possession. It was our own free choice that we walked into this sinful relationship. And Jesus says, I have the power to remove you from captivity to sin. And that's what He desires to do. But it's our choice as to whether or not that's going to take place. I think the Apostle Paul demonstrated for us the same kind of attitude that we see in this man that we need to see in ourselves. Do you remember as he was contemplating what might happen in his future? He wrote to the Philippians and he said, For to me to live is Christ and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and to be with Christ, for that is far better. Paul had made the same choice. Paul had been a captive to sin, and he had been freed by Jesus Christ. And he says, you know, when I think about it, dying would be so much better. Because if I die, I can go and I can be with Jesus. Just like that demon-possessed man who said, Let me go with you. The Apostle Paul says, I want to go with Jesus. I want to be with Him. Yet he says, I know there's good for me to do if the Lord allows me to remain on this earth. You see, that's the attitude that you and I need to be going toward. To understand that when we come into contact with God, the more I understand about Him and His power, the stronger my desire is to be with Him. Is that where I am today? Is that the choice that I'm making? Like the Apostle Paul, God may choose to leave us on this earth for a while. And if that is the case, just like the man who was formerly possessed with demons, God gives work for me to do. Jesus said to the man, You go home and you tell all your neighbors the power of God. That's exactly what Jesus tells us to do. that when we choose to be freed by Jesus Christ, when we choose to come out of captivity led by Jesus into the kingdom of God, he says, as long as you are on this earth, there are things that I want you doing, and I want you to go into your city, and I want you to proclaim my power to those who you know. That's the work we have to do, of spreading the message of Jesus Christ, to let others know in unabashed terms where we were and what Jesus has done for us. We don't know what happened to this man, but yet the last statement we read is tinged with excitement about going in and letting everybody know, proclaiming Jesus to them. Does that describe us? It's very easy to have that kind of excitement in the first few days after our conversion, only to allow that to grow mundane, to not even speak of it when we have the opportunity. Jesus says you need to have that excitement not only after your conversion, but throughout your life to proclaim me. And let's take it even a step further. Like this man, perhaps even to proclaim it to people whom I have heard in the past. Perhaps one of the most effective things we can do is to allow others to see the change in us, and especially those who we have hurt in the past. To let others know that Jesus Christ has changed me. I am now a different person. And it may very well be that that change will draw interest in Jesus Christ and lead to the conversion of those who we may have turned on before. That must be my choice. Jesus has the power to free. And when I am freed by Him, like that man, I then go and I share His power with the world. But that brings us, of course, to the important question. Have I been freed in Jesus Christ? Likely, if you're listening to this sermon, you have become a Christian. But in the event that someone is listening who is not a Christian, I want to ask you that question. Have you been set free through Jesus? Have you come to Him and in the waters of baptism had your sins washed away, resurrected with Him, ready for this new life? If not, you need to think very seriously about that. And if you are at a point in your understanding and say, I am ready to be free of evil, I'm ready for the freedom in Jesus Christ, you simply need to let me know. And we can make arrangements for you to come out of captivity and into the wonderful kingdom of God. Maybe, though, for those who are our Christians, we are convicted with how little excitement we have shown to others about this freedom in Jesus Christ. That can change also. Let's make a point. Like this poor man we've read about, who at the beginning had such a horrible story, but yet at the end is a rich man who has come into contact with Jesus and become a part of His number. Let's be like him and gladly proclaim this good news. If we can do that, then we'll understand what it means to have freedom in Jesus Christ and to see the true peace that this Prince of Peace offers. Thank you so much for joining in this study today.